From KLCC Media, this is the Oregon Grapevine. I'm Barbara Dellenbach. The Oregon Grapevine highlights fresh-pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live. Liz Von Wellheim is the medical director and co-founder of Elder Health and Living in Springfield, Oregon. She speaks locally and nationally on topics related to geriatrics, including dementia, geriatric medications, parent care, intimacy in old age, and when to worry about your memory. Well, thank you very much, Liz, for being here on Oregon Grapevine. I appreciate your time, and I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
Here we are getting older, and of course some symptoms of age are universal but and not necessarily worrisome, some a little more worrisome. I'd like to start, if we could, with the notion or myth, perhaps, of aging in place. I hear a lot of people who say, I'm not going to go anywhere, this is where I'm going to be. What are the realities of that?
Well, they're not too good. So let me break that down a bit. It's always interesting to me when a spouse or a child says to their parents, oh, I promise you I'll never put you in assisted living or a nursing home or whatever. And to me, you can't promise something you don't know. And it makes it very challenging to unravel that promise and thus with it all the guilt. And so particularly if you're a spouse and your health status declines, and your partner is getting dementia and wandering outside and, you know, peeing in corners, and you're just don't have enough resources to bring care into the home maybe, then you're looking at placing that loved one, spouse, into a care community and feeling horrible about it because you made this promise based on ignorance of what can possibly happen. And I guess if I had my druthers, everybody in high school or somewhere would get a class on aging, and part of that class would say something like, you can anticipate 3 to 5 years of frailty that may require movement into a care community or receiving care in your home. And then have that as your foundation of promises. And say, you know, we don't know what our finances are going to be when we're in our 20s, 30s, 40s necessarily. And so we don't know what's reasonable when we get into our 70s or 80s as far as, you know, bringing people into the house, which is the most expensive way to provide care, or going into an adult foster home or a assisted living or residential care facility, memory care, nursing home. You know, there's a whole spectrum of care opportunities, and we just don't know what's going to happen. And so let's plan on having long-term care insurance that'll help us, and let's plan on designating people that can help us make decisions if we're not able to do that. I guess my other thing I would love to do in the world is have all pediatricians, when they stop seeing their patients when they turn 18, say, okay, your parents can no longer speak for you. You are an adult, so I want you to fill out this advance directive and tell all of us what you would want in the event of, at that age, a motor vehicle accident or some catastrophe. What would you want your wishes to be regarding end-of-life decisions? And if we just started talking about it at age 18, we wouldn't have to have so much energy around trying to talk about it later when somebody needs to make those decisions shortly. Ideally, you can reflect on it and over the decades have a conversation. You can imagine what my dinner parties are like. Everyone, what do they want to happen when they have difficulty managing their own affairs? And they look at me and laugh. But we actually had one dinner party where we all did advance directives and, you know, just have the conversation about what might happen. You know, worst case scenario, best case scenario, throw in finances as far as you can anticipate, and then, you know, have that document tucked away for when something happens.
So if I get
that was a long-winded answer.
If I get a dinner invitation, I'm going to be ready.
Yeah, you should.
This is a huge question, but I will go ahead and ask it. Is there any or enough support socially, governmentally for seniors and for caregivers of seniors? And if the answer is no, do you see kind of simple solutions or simple things that could be set into place to help?
I don't think anything's simple. And no, there is no way that we have enough caregivers for the onslaught of the baby boomers as they go into their 80s and 90s. And, you know, the number of people over 100 is the highest growing demographic in America. So, I mean, people are getting old, old, old. And so they need care at some point on all kinds of levels. You know, they need transportation, which in our community, you know, is a bus system that's fair. And, you know, there's ride source and things like that. But we're not a society that wants to use public transportation. We want to drive our own cars. And so we haven't figured out what that's going to look like and how to manage just transportation to doctor's appointments, to social events, et cetera. And then the need for skilled caregivers, whether they're CNAs or lay people with skills that have been, that they have special training for. For instance, in memory care, you have folks that get specially trained for the management of memory care persons. You don't need to have a certified nursing assistant license. But either way, we don't have enough of them. And I think, you know, federally, they're talking about the minimum wage, and that's part of what the problem is. There's not enough money being spent on staffing and caregivers working with older people. It's not a very sexy job. It's not taught in school or vocational programs. There's very little tracks that you can go down to become a caregiver and to become really a master caregiver and good at it. It's just something people pick up as a almost as a last resort, or, you know, I took care of grandma when she was old, and now I think I want to go into taking care of older people. And when they actually get into the process and how complex, you know, older folks are, you know, with multiple medical conditions if they need care and medications and functionally transferring them from the wheelchair onto the toilet and giving a shower and entertaining them and all the rest of it, it's quite overwhelming. And most caregivers that start out in their 18, 19, 20-year-old don't make it, don't last very long, the last 6 months or a year. And it's, you know, maybe 20% of all people that start in the field actually make a career out of it and become very skilled and good at it. And it can be a very rewarding career, but that learning curve is very steep. So we would have to figure out a way to incorporate caring for older people in our curriculums in high school so that it isn't this weird thing and we never see old people. I think there's, you know, putting old people in care communities. Yes, it's necessary sometimes, but it also limits intergenerational connection. So there's this fear of talking to an old person. I do a lot of training with new caregivers, and really a big part of it is they're a normal person. They have a sense of humor. You can joke with them. You can talk about their history. You can talk about your kids. You can talk about your history. You can have a regular dialogue, but that's a concept that's new. And so building in bridges for young people to have connections with old people so that it isn't so scary, that there's a track in school that you can go into to be a caregiver, and maybe you'll go down and be a nurse or a physician or nurse practitioner, but maybe you're just going to go and learn really excellent skills on how to be a good caregiver, then that would be good. And then we just have to make the wages equivalent to construction workers that have, you know, similar training going into it, but they get paid a whole lot right at the upstart. So other than that, you know, just society has to recognize that there is this tsunami of old people coming.
In terms of just mental slips and aging and the tsunami of which I'm a part, and maybe we're all a part or lots of us are, you know, we all kind of have mental slips and we all kind of have issues where we can't remember names or whatever those however they manifest. At what point is it concerning?
Usually it's when your spouse says, oh my God, if I have to tell you one more time, something like that. But in actuality, the older you get, the part of your brain that hangs on, and this is my term because it's just how I explain it, these like nano memories that really come and go. So, you know, going into a room, you left the kitchen, you went into the garage to get X, and meanwhile, you got distracted and, you know, talked to someone or your phone rang or you read a text or a million other things. That hanging on to those pieces of information can be challenging the older you get. And when there's a disruption in the pathway, it's harder the older you get. And that's normal aging. The other interesting part is that studies show that old people deny that and are terrible at reporting or acknowledging when they've forgotten something or when they get something wrong because they don't process it that way. They don't hang on to it and believe it because they've always gotten everything right. And so makes it challenging for younger people sometimes to say, no, that isn't what you said 10 minutes ago. So normal aging, there is loss of cognitive function. Just like normal aging, there's loss of physical function. You know, you don't see 80-year-olds going and trying out for the Olympic trials. So we know that our bodies age, but so does our brain. Yes, we can get wiser. Some do, some don't. But our capacity to learn new information becomes more difficult, takes longer to teach an 80-year-old how to use a new cell phone or the remote on the TV or whatever it is. And that begins happening actually somewhere in your 20s. You begin having this cognitive change. So I always say to folks, who do you give a new cell phone to, a 13-year-old or a 25-year-old? Who's going to figure it out faster? And it's the 13-year-old. And it's because they haven't set down these pathways in their brain that we need to do to survive and function. Their brain has more plasticity to it, and so they can look at that cell phone and, you know, slide their finger up or press it down or, you know, open it, close it, do whatever. They don't expect it to behave like the cell phone that they had before, which is where I always get stuck. It's like, oh, I want it to work like my last one, and now I have to learn this whole new swipe thing, and it's driving me crazy. But that's because I have, you know, I've had 10 cell phones or whatever, and I build on those, and it makes, and that actually limits my capacity or delays it, I guess, makes it more difficult for me to learn a new cell phone than a 13-year-old or even a 25-year-old. So, you know, the solution to maintaining good cognitive health is to keep using your brain and using it in different things. So the old belief was, oh, I do the crossword puzzle. I do the New York Times crossword puzzle in pen every day, and so I guess I'm okay. And I say, well, yep, you're going to be good at doing the crossword puzzle in pen till the day you die, but that doesn't mean that you're going to have other cognitive attributes like executive function and memory and socially appropriate behavior and a million other things that our brain does. So what we have to do to keep our brain functional is use it on different things. You know, it was pick up a language, or for me, I started playing tennis, which uses kind of both hemispheres and has a million rules and a million physical things you have to do in addition to cognitive things that you need to do. We have to just keep building our brain. And so getting a new laptop, getting a new cell phone, you know, figuring it all out is vital to our brain growth, but also to us being able to connect with the community at large. I mean, I think if COVID's taught geriatric practitioners anything, it's that we need to do a much better job bringing 80-plus-year-olds into the IT world enough, because, I mean, the rate of suicide went up for the old, because they had limited connection. They didn't know how to Zoom or FaceTime or text or do any of that. And they were talking on the phone with their kids maybe, but not enough. And so that lack of connection and that lack of ability to use technology became devastating for many. So keep your brain healthy. Do things that are stressful and hard, and but stick with them. Have somebody that you trust in your circle of friends who's, you know, some people, I have this friend group, and one's good with legal, and I'm good with the medical nursing, and the other ones are IT gal. And so the three of us are like, okay, we make one person. But we can teach each other. So have resources going into old age.
I have to find my three.
and you got to really work at it.
Oh, dear. I also know sometimes, having had a mother-in-law with dementia and just experience with many, or at least exposure to many people in those circumstances, that there is difficulty with the child who all of a sudden has become kind of the parent. There's kind of an authority switch where you have to say, no, mom, you actually have to do this, or no, dad, you have to do this. And it creates it's really hard. So how do you help with that transition?
It can be excruciatingly hard when the roles change. And sometimes, you know, depending on the type of dementia, for instance, frontal temporal lobe dementia frequently is never, ever going to let go of anything. They're just, that type really hangs on, versus Alzheimer's, they, you know, you can move them along, you can coax them into doing something else, you can, you know, joke with them. Their attention span is short enough that you can just move through a stressful situation. But as they're entering a memory loss disease, and that lack of insight into their loss and judgment becomes very challenging, and it really puts a lot of pressure on whatever the relationship was or has been between parent and child. And the better that relationship is going into this phase, the easier it is to navigate when there's a lot of trust and reliance on kids to an extent, like a healthy reliance, like, hey, can you help me with my taxes? Or, you know what, I don't want dad to get up on the ladder. Can you come to our gutters, rather than the 90-year-old saying, I've always done the gutters, I know how to do the gutters, I'm going to do them and fall off the ladder and break my hip. So this transition of looking to your offspring to help, when that happens, you have a great foundation going into a cognitive loss. When that isn't there and they're fiercely independent and they are not aging gracefully, then every step of the way is going to be a challenge, because they don't know how to be graceful. They don't know how to receive help, and they don't believe they need it. And even when you say, I know you can do this, I just want to give it to you as a present, Dad. I just want to do the gutters. They see it as intruding on their independence and not as a gift. So it's challenging, and you really, each family is different, each family dynamic, how many siblings there are matters, what the financial strains are matter, you know, does the child have good boundaries in the world? Does she or he have good boundaries with their own children? Have they had good boundaries with their parents about other things as everybody's aged? You know, I'm moving to Oregon. If you want to come here, mom and dad, you can, but you need to understand that if you have trouble in Kansas, I'm not going to be there the next day because I have a job X, Y, and Z. But if you're welcome to move here, and that's clear. It's like, okay, this is what I can do, this is what I can't do. But versus, you know, my job took me to Oregon and I'll come home if I can, and not thinking, come to me, or what resources can we put together in Kansas, or who is in Kansas to continue to help, and to have the dialogue of what if mom or dad falls and breaks their hip or needs help or care, and talking that through. I mean, you know, kids and parents don't always talk that well, but, and then there's a crisis 90% of the time. There's a catastrophic event that occurs, usually a hip fracture or a motor vehicle accident, or they get the diagnosis of Alzheimer's or whatever, and then the family begins to gather and say, okay, now what are we going to do? And sometimes that event allows parents to move forward and have a cohesive plan. Other times it's, you know, it's everybody reverts back to the way they were when they were 5 years old, and it's miserable, and everything in between. It really, this pre-planning thing is so important, but our culture, we do not want to look at getting older for love or money. I mean, talking to younger folks about when you get this age or when you get older, what do you want it to look like? It's just not in their world, not something that we see around us all the time. So I recently heard from a colleague who did an international tour for her sabbatical. One of the things she learned is she went to Sweden, because they always tout how great their healthcare system is, and it was fascinating what they do with their geriatric population. They have more seniors living at home in their own houses till much later in life than we do here. And part of it is, at some point, they estimated that the cost of hip fractures related to gutter cleaning and ladders was X amount. So what's the cost of actually having, you know, handy people go out every fall and every spring and clean the roof, clean the gutters, do this for all people over the age of 70 or whatever it was. And they saved, you know, innumerable amounts of money, ER admissions, you know, surgeries, post-surgery rehab and all the rest of it, by just having available, free, for seniors, taking care of certain things on their house. I thought, gosh, you know, we should just do that. We're not going to do it on a national basis, because I can't imagine us all agreeing on it. But certainly families could begin to do that and just say, this is what I'm going to give you for Christmas, you know, or this is what I'm going to give you for your birthday, and begin to put those things in place so that there isn't a decision to be made about getting that ladder out. And I keep saying, talking about ladders, because they really are a huge fall risk, and so common to affect the quality of life if you fall off it and break your back. I mean, it's the rest of your life is living with physical impairment. And was it really worth going up on that ladder, you know, at age 75?
I just heard a story today from a friend, and I've heard other examples of this story in the past, where there was a lot of resistance to moving. This particular person just was not going to leave their house. They were not going to do it. It sounds miserable. Eventually, they were convinced for a number of reasons that they needed to move into another situation. And about 2 months into it, she came home and said to her family member, "This is great. I don't know why I didn't do this before." How do we get there as a
right
rule?
Well, I think a lot of things. We have to demystify levels of, you know, care or living places, retirement centers and assisted living. We have to demystify it by bringing young people in there to see it. And, you know, young people, even people in their 40s and 50s and 60s, to begin to go see these places, and hopefully they begin to have some friends that are there that they can visit and say, you know, they're having more fun than I am. You know, they get to play ping pong and swim in the pool and play bridge or whatever. They always have people around to do stuff. I think a lot of times people wait too long and don't get to enjoy it as much. I usually counsel families to say, look, you know, this is what the future looks like, the sooner you make this transition, the easier it will be for them to adapt and make friends and, you know, have this be a positive experience. If you wait too long and there's enough cognitive impairment, they have less resources to deal with. But I think it's this, in general, this fear of aging and fear of being frail and fear of looking old. If I move into retirement, then I'm old, rather than, wow, you know what? I don't have to clean my apartment. I don't have to make meals. You know, I can play. But we are so ageist, and old people are the most ageist, by the way, and do not want to look old for love or money. And so that just that one step into retirement can be overwhelming. Usually people move in during a crisis. You know, something catastrophic happens and the kids come home from all over the place and say, Mom, you got to move. And everybody puts their foot down and kind of forces the situation, which is a horrible way to do anything because you don't have time to go look at all the available facilities and communities, and you don't, and the person moving in doesn't get to go look and see and taste the food and, you know, get the culture of the place. But it's generally how things happen.
Move before you're ready.
Yes. Downsize before you ever thought you should. Just the minute the kids move out, the house is probably too big. Downsize. Go that first move of putting things in boxes and sorting and simplifying your life at that transition time makes all the other transitions easier. It's like you do that once. It's like, oh, my God, we've lived here with the kids for 30 years and the garage is packed. And it's like, well, let's just chip away at this and plan in 1 year to be living, you know, in a two-bedroom house instead of a five-bedroom house, or, you know, move into a condo or move into, you know, a senior community or whatever it is. But that step, while you're totally healthy, cognitively intact, but just that closing down of all those years of collected things makes all the other transitions much easier.
Thank you so much for your perspective and information.
Thank you for calling me and asking me to do this.
You've been listening to KLCC Media's The Oregon Grapevine, fresh, pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live.